You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, April 14th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, Marie Gottschalk, on her book, Caught, The Prison State and the Lockdown of American Politics. Also on the program today, debate as to whether or not I will attend the podcast awards ceremony in Las Vegas this evening, as I am en route to Las Vegas, as you hear this, undoubtedly. Dennis Miller, no longer the MC, which is a strike against. Also, I have no idea whether or not we won. It's too late to do anything about it. So I'm just not sure. But for the rest of this week, starting Thursday, I should say, I will be broadcasting live from the Mass Torts conference I attend twice a year sometimes, of trial lawyers, plaintiff litigators, whatever you want to call them, discussing some of major cases, some that are unknown cases, usually involving corporate malfeasance. It's the fifth anniversary, I think, of the BP settlement. And hopefully I'll be talking to some lawyers who actually sat on the committee there. But we shall see. In the meantime, I also think I'm going to be talking to Cenk Uygur, who is going to be also at the conference. So it should be interesting. But that is why I am on a flight to Las Vegas at the moment. Literally, I think, at the moment. I am still on that flight. This is an interview that we recorded yesterday with Marie Gottschalk. And for members, Matt and Mike will be here. And then tomorrow it will be a Matt and Mike Wednesday. I know. It feels like I'm never around. But on the other hand, for those who don't listen live, it feels like I never left. So put that in your pipe and smoke it. That's the only thing I can, the only way I can address that situation. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Marie Gottschalk. Then I will outro the interview and take us into the funner half. Just a reminder, folks, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member today at majority.fm. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. We get a kickback. You just go there, you click on the link, you bookmark it. You don't have to do anything different. We get a kickback. You don't notice any change. And, of course, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. And they have free shipping all this month, so this is the month to try it. You've been waiting to try it. See if it's worth it. Now is the time to do it. So do it. All right, folks, take a quick break. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor Marie Gottschalk, a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and author of the recently released Caught, The Prison State and the Lockdown of American Politics. Welcome to the program, Marie.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with, and I think to a certain extent, this audience has certainly heard some of these statistics before, but they are still incredibly disturbing. Just give us a sense of where we are as a country relative to the rest of the world in terms of our carceral state, as you call it.
Our incarceration rate is about 730 per 100,000, which is about 5 to 12 times the rate of other Western countries and Japan. And it's about five times the historic rate in the United States for much of the 20th century.
I mean, so we are, I mean, that is, even compared to ourselves, we're at an incredible peak. I mean, how long of a period of time are we talking about that we've been up in this sort of, I guess, record-breaking period of incarceration?
Well, it's increased exponentially over the last 40 years since about the mid-1970s, and it's sort of stabilized in about 2009. It's dipped down slightly, but then it went up last year. So we're kind of stabilized now at around 700 or a little above that. I think what's more surprising is not only the people who are incarcerated, but the number of people who are somehow in the criminal justice system and being watched by the state. And that is one out of every 23 adults in the United States. So one out of every 100 is incarcerated, but one out of 23 is on parole, probation, in jail, in prison, doing community service, in immigrant detention. And that, to me, is even a more alarming figure.
I mean, and so when we talk about those sort of, I guess, those people who are in some fashion or another in control of the state, is that area of probation? Are there sort of innovations there? Is it just simply we're putting more people into that part of the system?
Well, there certainly are innovations. I don't know if they're positive innovations or not. So many of these people in parole and probation are being watched by the state rather than being helped by the state to reenter into society. So if you go back in time, parole or probation was a way to help people find a job, resettle themselves with housing. Now, increasingly, parole and probation are ways to catch people for recidivating or for failing technical violations of their parole, and those can be very minor offenses, anything from having a six-pack of beer in your refrigerator to having a dirty urine test to going out of town without informing your parole officer.
All right, I want to circle back to that, but let's sort of finish up on the demographic end.
Mm-hmm.
Give us a sense of if we're in a period over the past 30-some-odd years of sort of peak incarceration, or at least relative to our history, and certainly in terms of relative to other industrialized countries, who makes up our prison population? Because I think to a certain extent, this is where there's a couple of areas, I think, in your book, which I think people would find surprising. And sort of the demographics is one of those.
So we can talk about race and we can talk about class. So the incarceration rate for African Americans is about 2,300 per 100,000. So we have about, proportionally African Americans to white, about 5-to-1 or 6-to-1 African Americans incarcerated compared to whites. So this, if you look at those raw numbers, we often think, okay, this is largely a problem for African Americans and not for the wider society or for whites, especially since the white incarceration rate is about 400 per 100,000. But if you take the white incarceration rate and you compare it to European countries, it's actually very, very high. So our white incarceration rate only looks low when we compare it to African Americans. But even if you took all African Americans out of prison and jail today, we would still have a mass incarceration crisis in the United States. And I should add, one of our biggest growing population are Hispanics. So the Hispanic rate is about 1,000 per 100,000 people in the United States. And our largest population now in federal prisons are people of Hispanic origin.
Okay. And so and where are they trending? So we have essentially African Americans are incarcerated at a rate six times greater than white people in this country. And the white people rate is higher than other countries. And then Hispanics.
Right, about twice at the high end of Europe.
And Hispanics,
four or five times the rate of the low end of Europe.
So, I mean, which how are these trending? In other words, are these rates moving in any direction, or are they basically static?
What we've seen now is the incarceration rate for African Americans has been going down a little bit as the war on drugs has been dialed down. So the ratio between blacks and whites used to be more like 7 or 8 to 1, and now it's settled back to its more historical rate of 5 to 6 to 1. What we are seeing is a slight growing incarceration of whites, and particularly of white women. White women are one of our fastest growing populations. We've seen a significant drop in the incarceration rate for African American women, again, largely because of the war on drugs, but it's still very, very high.
What accounts for the increase in the incarceration rates of white women?
That's a good question. What some people are speculating is that it's the growth in poverty for white women and the conditions that often lead to contact with the criminal justice system. So poor health care, poor mental health care, poverty. And what we've seen for poor white women is actually a drop in their life expectancy rates, which some people are saying is indicative of their higher deterioration of their life conditions.
Interesting. And to what extent, I was recently talking to someone about the increase in the jail population as opposed to the prison population in this country. But what do you know about the rates and where they sit historically? And I imagine it's off the charts relative to other Western industrialized nations, but in terms of mental illness and imprisonment.
Right. So you got two questions there. So when I was giving you incarceration rates, those were jail and prison combined. And in both state prisons and jails, we have a huge population of people with mental health issues. So they are de facto now our mental health hospitals in the United States. They have the, you know, if you take a city like Los Angeles or Chicago, they're treating people with mental illness at a much larger rate than the local public health system is treating them.
Wow. And does that... Has that been, I mean, I want to talk about, I guess, and move into, now that we have a sense of just how many people and who they are being incarcerated, and this is obviously, you could write a book on this, but
a couple of books.
Exactly. The reasons why this has gone up, I mean, or how much I should say, there are obviously multiple reasons, but what's attributable to what?
Right. So there are immediate causes, which are changes in public policy. So the tough on sentencing, longer sentences, three strikes and you're out, determinant sentences, truth in sentencing, all the kind of harsh crime sentencing policies that we instituted, including the war on drugs. There are deeper underlying causes of, well, you know, why did we impose so many of these strict sentences and these strict policies, and that's a larger kind of political and economic question.
Well, I want to get to that question, but let me just clarify something too. So when we talk about longer sentences, that means that the rate of incarceration, all things being equal, would have remained steady through the years. It's just the duration of which we keep people in prison has increased the prison population. Is that right?
Well, that's part of it, right? So we're sending more people into prison, and we're keeping them there for a longer period of time.
And so let's talk about what led to these longer sentences, because and I think this is one of those things that I think people will find a little bit surprising in some ways, that at the very least, some of what can be attributed to these longer sentences is obviously the Republican right wing tough on crime mentality, but also sort of, I guess, political missteps by the left. Is that a fair assessment, or just explain to us what happened in that regard?
Right. So it depends upon what period you're talking about. But if you know, people conventionally date this to the 1960s and the rise of Barry Goldwater and Richard Nixon, and the code words for talking about race became talking about law and order and crime, and you couldn't frontally ignite people's racial animosity, so you did it through the back door, talking about law and order and a war on crime and a war on drugs, and that this was part of the Southern strategy as the Democratic Party ruptured over civil rights and the Republican Party moved to conquer the South electorally. Some of the new research is saying now that, in fact, we need to go back to the 40s and 50s in the way that the Democratic Party responded to the law and order and the rise in lynchings and protests, civil rights protests and attacks of police on civil rights workers, and that Democrats themselves enshrined law and order into our debates, and that Democrats themselves were very supportive of giving more power to the police and militarizing the police and giving them the wherewithal to then carry out this war on crime and this war on drugs, and that many, there are complicated reasons, but many groups traditionally associated with the left didn't push back against that. They were fragmented, they were co-opted for various reasons.
I mean, what was behind that? I mean, was that a function of political expediency? Was it a misstep in terms of, I mean, at one point I know you talk about race, I think Democrats, I think, or I
Right.
Tell us about what that dynamic, what that means, and how
right.
sort of procedural concern about procedures sort of meant that we've got to sort of, I guess, make the system of imprisoning people more egalitarian but harsher.
Right. So many Democrats felt like if we focus on procedural justice, that we give everybody an equal sentence, right, regardless of their individual circumstances, that this would reduce racial disparities in the system.
What does that mean, so, procedural? Explain to us what that means.
So in the past, we relied a lot on indeterminate sentences. So judges could look at someone's individual circumstances and come up with a sentence based on that person's particular circumstances. You know, they may have stolen that car because they had a mortgage payment to pay, and everything else being equal, they were a good standing citizen, or they may have stolen that car because they're in the center of a ring that's regularly stealing lots of cars, and they're actually quite wealthy from stealing cars. And we might think of those two individual situations very differently. Once you have determinate sentences, you're saying you stole that car, you get this sentence, maximum, minimum sentence, no matter what your individual circumstances were. And there was a belief that this would reduce racial disparities because everybody would be treated equally. But what ended up happening is that in making these determinate sentences, we made very, very harsh sentences. So basically we're saying everybody is going to be subject to these very, very harsh sentences, whether you're black or whether you're white. And since African Americans get picked up more by the criminal justice system, they're going to get these more of these fixed long sentences.
And that is just another sort of, I guess, dynamic that is operating.
Right.
Give us a sense of what the relationship is between sort of the welfare state and prisons during this time. Because when we talk about other Western industrialized countries, we talk about things like mental health, and then also sort of, I guess, just sort of the other countries don't have the depth and breadth of poverty that we have. And address that, but also talk about it, because I think we got through sort of the racial disparities in terms of the prison population, or those people who are sort of trapped in the overseen by the state in some way, but not so much the class.
Right. So what we do know is that high rates of incarceration tend to trend more with states, individual states in the United States, or countries overall that have anemic welfare states. And what we've seen in the United States is states that have exhibited the highest growth in incarceration rate have had the biggest contractions of their welfare states. So when I gave you that overall 700 per 100,000 figure for incarceration, it actually obscures the great variation in the United States. We can go from 200 or 300 per 100,000 in a Maine or a Minnesota, and we're up at 1,600 per 100,000 in Louisiana. So what we see, it seems to be, is some tracking between contraction of the welfare state and expansion of the carceral state. What we also see is that a number of other countries exhibited a crime blip in the 60s and 70s, and then again in the late 80s and early 90s. And that crime blip tracked the United States, but at a lower rate. Many of these other countries responded to their kind of blip increase in crime by expanding their welfare state capacity to reduce crime. And the United States had a choice, that we had this kind of crime shock from the mid-60s to the mid-70s, and instead of saying, well, maybe we need to increase our welfare state capacity, we actually said, oh, this was the period of the Great Society, we were increasing our welfare state capacity, and crime went up. So instead, the only thing we can do is increase our criminal justice capacity. So it was a very different response than from a number of countries overseas.
Now, when we talk about the welfare, I mean, the data from in this country where you see contraction of the welfare state ends up sort of is not necessarily, I guess, sort of like loosely correlated with, I don't know what the degree of correlation is, but we see it reflected in the spending in the prison. Is that to suggest that the sort of the contraction of the welfare state causes more crime per se, or is it that something else is going on? Because, you know, sort of in the back of my mind, I'm one of those people who subscribes to the sort of the diminishment in lead theory as to reduction, at least in violent crimes and whatnot.
And that incarceration led to a reduction in violent crime?
No, I'm talking literally lead from...
lead paint.
Paint and, right. And lead and gasoline. And so, right. You know, I'm wondering, like, how sensitive is crime actually sensitive to the welfare state, or is it that there is just a different attitude in those states that would contract the welfare state, literally state I'm talking now, contract the welfare state, and it also just sort of correlates with an attitude of like, and incidentally, let's crack down on just, you know, loiterers.
Right. So we have two problems here, and one of the main issues is that we conflate them. There's a crime problem and there's an incarceration problem, and they're not the same thing. So I just spent 2 years serving on the National Academy of Sciences Committee on the Causes and Consequences of High Rates of Incarceration. And there were 20 experts from around the country, and we came to consensus agreement looking at the best scientific evidence that the increase in incarceration may have caused a decrease in crime, but the magnitude of the results was quite small. So that this idea that we had dramatically increasing crime, which increased our incarceration rate, is not true. The evidence is just not there that that's what fueled the incarceration rate. What we still have in the United States are pockets of very, very high crime areas, despite the overall decrease in the national rates of crime. And in order to address those pockets of very, very high crime, we need to build up the welfare state again. And we need to address the root causes of crime, you know, homelessness, lack of public housing, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not what caused the rise in incarceration. so that when we think about how do we get out of this today, the way to get out of this is to have comprehensive sentencing reform, to not be sending so many poor people from these communities to prison, that that's not going to reduce the crime rate in their communities, and it actually may increase the crime in their communities by destabilizing those communities, by taking so many young women and men out of those communities in the prime of their lives. And one of the points I try to make in the book is not to conflate the crime problem and the incarceration problem. We can fix the incarceration problem over the short term by changing our policies. We need to address these high crime problems and these root causes of crime, and that takes a longer term solution.
So when we talk about an incarceration problem, I mean, what are we talking about? Is it, are we framing it in the context of we're spending, I mean, you know, because this is, you know, and we've talked about prisons and incarceration reform on this program a decent amount, because it's one of the sort of few areas where there is supposedly some level of bipartisan, bi-ideological, I guess, consensus. For the reasons why are not necessarily there, but everybody sort of comes to the party for their own reasons. A lot of what we hear is it's too costly, right? I mean, but is that the reason? When we talk about our incarceration problem, are we just talking to, from a moral perspective? We have more people in prison than repressive regimes?
I think we're overstating the economic costs. The costs have certainly gone up, and they've been the fastest growing portion of state budgets behind Medicaid. That said, criminal justice is only about 2-3% of state expenditures, or about half of what states typically spend on highways. So if we're saying there's an economic logic to it, it's a minimal economic logic. The second point of that is that the economic costs are not or pressures are not going to be enough to hold together the kind of coalition or social movement that you need over the long term to actually undo the carceral state. And the final point I want to make is that if the economic issues are so compelling, then why are people in the Right on Crime coalition not supporting Medicaid expansion? Medicaid expansion would put about $100 billion into Texas over the next decade, and much of that money would go to the very people who are most vulnerable to being picked up and recycled through the criminal justice system.
Well, I mean, wait a second. So your point is that the money is not that big of a deal to the states, because if it was, we wouldn't see such hesitation to pick up to expand Medicaid. Two things on that. One is there any evidence that states with increased expanded Medicaid services end up having less crime or less incarceration? And two, I think, you know, playing devil's advocate here, I think if I was governor of Texas, I would just say, well, for freedom's sake, we don't take that money,
right.
As ridiculous as that sounds.
Well, freedom's sake, right, is competing with the logic of the Right on Crime. And somehow the logic of the Right on Crime of this bipartisan moment ignores that there's resistance to doing what I think is probably the most important thing you can do in the short term now to alleviate mass incarceration, which is to support Medicaid expansion. In terms of
how does that
states,
work? How does the Medicaid expansion achieve that?
You would have a lot of able-bodied, young, poor adult males and women who right now don't qualify for health care, they would qualify under Medicaid, and they would get the mental health substance abuse services that they need. And also state prisons would be able to offload some of their costs of medical costs for people who are incarcerated onto the federal government through Medicaid. People would also be able to come out of prison or jail with a Medicaid card, so there would be a continuity in their health care, which they don't experience right now. And, you know, ACA, the Affordable Care Act, is still in its infancy, so we don't have studies saying what's the relationship between criminal justice and ACA. But we do have the case of New York State, which has seen its prison population drop by about a quarter over the last few years, one of the biggest drops in the country. And even prior to ACA, they had a much more liberal Medicaid policy and taking in a much larger catchment of people than other states.
So, I mean, so there, but there's no hard data, right? I mean,
the hard data we do have is that if we supply people with better substance abuse, better public health, and mental health services, there's a lot better chance they won't end up being treated in prison and jail or end up going to prison and jail. We also have hard data that if people have these services when they come out and we just don't drop them with, you know, $10 and a bus ticket when they come out, they will have a better chance of reintegrating back into society rather than cycling in and out of the criminal justice system.
I mean, let's talk about just briefly, if we could. I mean, there were two other things that struck, I guess three other things. So, I mean, one is this notion that I think some on the left assume that the rise, and we've talked about the reasons why there's been this rise in the incarcerated or those people who are sort of under the control of the state from a criminal standpoint. But there's a presumption that it's a function of the drug, the war on drugs, and that's not the case. I mean, you've explained to us sort of why it's been. There's been sort of an increase in the, I guess, has there been an increase in the punitive nature of prisons as opposed to the rehabilitative nature of prisons?
Well, that's certainly true, right? We certainly had more of this idea that prisons are places that people go to be warehoused rather than that they go to receive services and be treated as citizens, so that the leaner and meaner we can make prisons, that's better. And I think we're beginning to at least ideologically question that idea, but the reality is that we continue to have some of the most dehumanizing, degrading prisons. As for the war on drugs, about 20% of the people overall in state prisons now are there because of drug offenses. So even if you took all the drug offenders out of prison, we would still have the highest incarceration rate in the world.
And if we were to end the war on drugs, would that have a disparate effect on African American prison rates versus whites? Or I mean, who would that impact the most?
Right. So it would disproportionately impact African Americans, but it depends. Are we just rolling back the policies or are we rolling back the broader police procedures, right? Because mm-hmm. what we've seen is that with the war on drugs, procedures and equipment and states of mind that we use to fight drugs have migrated to fighting other things. So that we have this militarization of the police that in part was fueled by the war on drugs, but now migrates to fighting quote-unquote other kinds of crime or other kinds of behavior of the police, and that's very problematic. So you're serving a warrant for not a high-profile crime, but you do it through a whole SWAT team, and you have all this military equipment in part because of how we militarize the war on drugs.
The other thing that struck me in the book has been the rise in the incarceration of sex offenders. In the mm-hmm. Talk about that, because that's I think something that sort of makes people feel uncomfortable. The idea that they would be defending shorter prison terms for so-called sex offenders.
So when I say sex offenders to people, they imagine a pedophile abusing. A serial pedophile abusing children and incorrigible with very high recidivism rates. The reality is that sex offenders can be anybody who's done public flashing, public urination, a Romeo and Juliet crime where, you know, you're 18 and you have underage sex with someone who's 15, and that many sex crimes fall into that category. And what we've seen is a war on sex offenders that's comparable in the policies and the intensity to the war on drugs. And nobody wants to talk about this war on sex offenders. And not only have we been incarcerating many sex offenders, but we load enormous restrictions on them when they come out, registration restrictions, where they can live, community notification, and we're increasingly pushing them more and more underground and banishing them in American society, increasing the likelihood that, in fact, they will recidivate because they've not been reintegrated into society. In some state prisons now, sex offenders are 30% of the population.
Wow. And do you have data on when we talk about recidivism being high, do we have data on how many end up back in prison because they've committed a crime other than sex offenders? I mean, this thing, you know, I mean, I've heard that story of, like, the kid was in high school, he was 18 and she was 16,
right.
And they had sex and he is now a sex offender. And if I take out my little app that says, you know, offender locator, I can see where the guy's living
right.
in his picture.
Right.
And that stays with him for the rest of his life or something. He can't get work. He can't even find a place to live there. You know, he's living at some, like, a motel. Do we have data as to whether or not they end up, like, committing crime, becoming, you know, having a drug problem and, you know, whatever it is?
The best data indicates that sex offenders, depending on their age, particularly young sex offenders, may actually have some of the lowest recidivism rates.
Hmm.
But the data also shows that if you don't reintegrate people who've been convicted of sex offenses and you marginalize them and you increase their stigma and you increase their anxiety, all those are things that contribute to reoffending.
Interesting. All right. So lastly, let me ask you. So the story I think that you tell of incarceration in this country is one that sort of politics built an increase in our incarceration numbers, and then sort of it was almost like businesses were built around that, and now there's, like, these intense moneyed interests. Is that a fair assessment? I mean, walk us through that.
I think there's a fault on the left for saying that we got the carceral state because of economic interests and that it's primarily a prison industrial complex. And as I try to show in the book, the economic factors are far more complicated and in the early years probably far more insignificant. That said, the things that built the carceral state are not the same things that sustain it today. And today, economic interests are very important. And economic actors like the two largest prison companies, the GEO Group and Corrections Corporation of America, CCA, have become very powerful and very nimble political actors. And they are reading these changes in the political scene and adapting to them. So if you read their corporate reports, they're talking, for example, about they need to invest more in the corrections life cycle and to privatize parole and to privatize probation and to increase drug testing of people so more people will be bounced back into the system. So they're not staying politically stagnant in any kind of way. And so we have these increasingly powerful and entrenched economic interests in the carceral state, but they were not the primary drivers of it in the early years.
When they talk about corrections life cycle, does that mean like we want to privatize everything that happens when they leave the prison? We want to be the ones to provide the ankle bracelets. We want to be the
right.
ones, all of that.
Right. In fact, recently one of the big corrections company bought the company that is the major producer of ankle bracelets and electric monitoring. They also are looking to say, okay, states are cutting back on the number of people in state prisons. We need to, and they're transferring, devolving more people to jails. So we need to get into the business of privatizing jails. We also need to continue to push for very harsh immigration policies because federal detention and privatization of federal detention of immigrants is going to be a big growth area for us and may offset any reductions in the state or local incarcerated population.
I mean, so they must look at the sort of relaxation of drug laws in this country, the hopefully imminent end to the drug war as a real business challenge to them.
It is a business challenge, but I think that they also feel quite confident about how to meet that challenge. And the other thing is that in periods of national hysteria over cutting deficits and cutting debt, these are moments, and when that's the political gestalt that rules bipartisan in both parties, that's a moment historically when privatization makes great gains.
Right.
That the private sector is able to say, we can do it less, and states and counties and other government jurisdictions jump in and say, oh, go ahead and privatize, and we're not going to look very much at regulation, and we're not going to ask many questions. And so the private sector is capitalizing on this kind of overwhelming obsession with deficit politics now from both parties to make significant inroads in privatizing not only more prisons and jails, but also this kind of corrections life cycle.
And we know, I mean, the irony is that there's not much data out there that show that there's much savings involved in this. But I guess to a certain extent, it's also like we don't want the liability. You guys are able to run these things with a lot more, I guess, leeway than we would be able to.
That's correct, and also things don't apply like Freedom of Information Acts in a private prison or jail. So it's hard to get the data. And also, as we see in the healthcare sector, the private sector in prisons is able to cream and to get the cheapest prisoners, right, who don't cost the most money. So you don't want geriatric prisoners that have lots of healthcare costs. You don't want maximum security people who might have lots of security correction officer costs.
Interesting. And so is there a solution, or is it just going to be a long political fight?
Or is that the solution? The solution is the two solutions, right? One is we need to change these policies and have comprehensive sentencing reform, and as I talked about earlier. But what we need to politically be on guard for now, and this is where the right on crime comes from, is everyone says, oh, politics is so polarized in Harrisburg or in Washington or in other state capitals that we can't do anything. We can't get Gottschalk's wish list of comprehensive sentencing reform, so we need to go after these small bore right on crime solutions because that's only what is politically feasible. And the important point to realize is that in the early years, mass incarceration was built not by policies and laws, but by a change in the thinking of people on the front lines of law enforcement. And prosecutors, police, judges still retain enormous discretion, and they can choose to use their discretion in a more punitive way or in a less punitive way. And while we have all this polarization in state capitals, prosecutors, police, judges can step out to do what they're doing in a different way. And so we've been seeing some important acts of political courage of people on the front lines deciding to do things differently. So we can think of the DA in the Bronx, Kenneth Thompson. We can think of Kamala Harris in San Francisco and California when she was the district attorney of San Francisco. We can think of Rick Ramish, who's the director of corrections in Colorado, who wrote that wonderful op-ed in the New York Times questioning solitary confinement, and then recently opening two mental health prisons in Colorado and making a ban on using solitary confinement in those prisons. So part of my argument is that we can't just look to law and legislation, because then we're going to say, oh, well, the politics are too polarized, and we ignore all the individual discretion. You know, President Obama could release lots of people today under executive clemency, and he's chosen not to do so. And we don't need any changes in law. We need a change in his thinking. And unfortunately, he's been very cowardly compared to many previous presidents on this issue, or not his immediate predecessors, but presidents in the early part of the 20th century.
Marie Gottschalk, professor of political science at University of Pennsylvania, author of Caught, The Prison State and the Lockdown of American Politics. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks so much, Sam, for having me.
And that is our interview with Marie Gottschalk. We're going to head into the fun half of the program. Matt and Michael will entertain you with some funny audio, apparently, they have, including the audio of Michael's cold, which he seems to be hanging on to because I guess maybe it brings him some sense of attention. It's like sort of a, it's sort of like a, what is it, the Baron Munchausen syndrome that Michael has? That's I'm not sure. Maybe it's not Baron Munchausen.
Yeah, it's Munchausen. I think it's something like that, Munchausen. I know when you make someone else sick, it's Munchausen by proxy. So
right.
It's probably just Munchausen if you make yourself sick.
Yeah, there you go. So Michael's making himself sick with the hopes of getting some attention, but it's not working. So I'm sorry, Michael.
Is this a new feature on the show that when we're pre-recording and Michael's not in the office, we talk about him?
Definitely.
I
don't
like
even
it.
Consider it
I
new.
Like it.
It just so happens. You snooze, you lose. All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Matt and Michael will be here. Matt and Michael will be here tomorrow, and then I'll be back Thursday doing a full show Thursday and Friday from Las Vegas. We'll be right back after this break. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM us on all of the IM machines. Don't forget, great time to get just coffee. .coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. 646-257-3920. Back in just.
By the next available representative.
You can talk to us, Matt and Mike.
Oh.
646-257-3920.
Yeah, no, I gave him the number.
Maybe if they hear it from me, though.
No, maybe. All right, be right back.